Hello, I'm Rafi Stein, and this is number 0108, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0108. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet former CTV Quebec City Bureau Chief Kai Nagata, who talks about the way he left his job and what the future holds. Does he have any regrets about how his last job came to an end?
If I do have regrets, it's around the haste with which I got this impulse. This is something that was more powerful than me. I couldn't have stayed, I don't think. But I was forced to make a decision much quicker than I had hoped for. And that, I think, has left somewhat of a bitter taste. And for that, I apologize to my former employers. I think that that's not particularly fair as an employee to pull the rug out like that. And I recognize that bridges may have been burnt. I hope not permanently. That's something that I hope, given time, that we can heal.
Filmmaker Susan Graham. She's originally from Texas, moved to New York, and then to L.A. Did she have any misconceptions about heading west?
There are a lot more breast implants in the city and a lot more tanning salons. I think that people are generally warm, you know, and happy, and you can find good quality people anywhere. So I have to say, a lot of my judgments about Los Angeles before I moved here as being sort of an intellectual, snobby New Yorker were definitely wrong.
And Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nellman, and this time on Book Banter, we investigate Kathy Reich's latest book, Flesh and Bones, not to mention a couple of other books that would make Quincy proud. That's all coming up, or dug up, later on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0108, is Rafi Stein, who is an engineering student at Concordia University. He comes from a family of loyal listeners, and he's also an upcoming groom. This December, he's going to be married to Adina Cohn, who will be graduating herself as a full-fledged interior designer this June. So congratulations to both of you. Rafi also teaches a computer course for seniors at the Creative Social Center, whose website is cscmtl.com, and Rafi set up that website for them, by the way, so check that out. Thank you very much, Rafi, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, it looks like 32-year-old Edwin Charles Toberta has got some problems. Police in Hamilton, Ohio arrested him after he allegedly got nasty with a neighbor's pink inflatable raft in an alley. The neighbor allegedly spotted Charles on top of the flotation device with his pants down around his ankles, according to a police report. Screams from the upset neighbor interrupted Chuck's passionate moment, but it didn't totally deflate his lust for the raft. He reportedly pulled up his pants and fled, but he took the raft with him. When police caught up to Chuck, he allegedly admitted to the dirty deed, but begged for mercy, claiming that he, quote, has a problem and needs help. Now, Chuck's grandmother told reporters he has a history of mental problems and that he's been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and has abused his medication. I don't know. His attention seemed to be fine until he was interrupted by his neighbor. Sounds like grandma's making excuses. Gosh, you just never know what your neighbors are up to, do you? By the way, here's another example. Authorities in Ogden, Utah are considering filing charges after they found a man butchering a cow in his driveway. Police got a call from a neighbor who reported a neighbor cutting up the cow in his driveway. The caller told authorities they heard what sounded like a gunshot shortly before the butchering began. When officers arrived, our friend was removing the cow's head. He denied shooting the animal and told the officer it had been delivered dead. Prosecutors are now reviewing the case for potential charges, including possible health code violations. Beef. It's what's for dinner. And apparently it's very fresh. Okay, there's a puzzling panty problem in Ohio. Police are trying to figure out why hundreds of pairs of mostly women's underwear were dumped along the side of the road. Fairfield County Deputy Gary Hamel said the undergarments were found in trees and on hillsides in several spots on a road in Burn Township. That's about 30 miles southeast of Columbus. Many of the panties were still folded the way they'd come in packaging, while others appeared to have been worn. There were nearly 1,700 pairs in all, enough to fill 10 large trash bags in a mix of colors and patterns. So far, investigators are baffled as to where the panties came from. This brings a whole new meaning to the term panty raid, doesn't it? And in East Naples, Florida, 27-year-old Corey William Morrell was practicing his martial arts in the house. And because he still lives at home with Mom, Mom wasn't too happy about all this and told him to knock it off. Instead, he allegedly gave her a good martial arts kick to the head, knocking her unconscious for 5 minutes. When deputies arrived, they said Morrell's mother was unable to recall what happened and appeared disoriented and nervous. She yelled several times at Morrell, asking him what happened. Morrell said it was all an accident and he was the one who called 911. That's a good son, huh? Yeah, right. A mom was transported to an NCH hospital for further medical treatment. Morrell faces a charge of domestic battery, and I'm also assuming he might be looking for some new digs when he gets out or when Mom gets home or both. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the program, you may soon be thinking about perfume in a completely new way. Scientists from Harvard and also Australia have been busy developing perfume scents in capsule form that you swallow. Harvard University synthetic biologist Sharif Mansi and Australian body architect Lucy McRae say the pill enables the human skin to emit a genetically unique scent. In short, fragrance molecules are excreted through the skin's surface while you perspire. McRae says the potency of the scent is determined by each individual's acclimatization to temperature, stress, exercise, or sexual arousal. But you may have to wait a while. The project is still in the research phase, and there's no word on a release date. Well, whenever it becomes available, it will be just my luck to get into an elevator with someone who is basically OD'd. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in July, former CTV reporter Kai Nagata suddenly quit his bureau chief job in Quebec City. Normally, a story like that wouldn't draw a lot of attention except from other people within the media, but Kai also wrote a blog, a manifesto of sorts, as to why he quit. That garnered a lot of attention, both pro and con. Kai Nagata is on the line with us right now from British Columbia to bring us up to date on what he's been up to. We talked to him via Skype-to-Skype communications. Hi, Kai.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to talk to you once again, sir.
Yeah, good to hear your dulcet tones.
I'm sure when you first sat down back in July on the 8th and wrote to the blog why I quit my job, you never anticipated the attention it would garner.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there were people who assumed or who suggested later that I had somehow engineered this social media coup as a way to propel myself to a book deal or some sort of reality TV deal, and that's just something that no sane person would do, I think. I had no idea it was going to go viral like that, and was really just trying to explain to viewers and to colleagues and to my family what was going on inside my head at that time.
Okay, so now that it has gone viral, what are your thoughts on the concept of it doing so, and what does that say about media as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think that there were a number of unique circumstances around that blog that probably helped push it beyond the immediate circle of the people who would have otherwise heard about it through colleagues. You know, if we work in the same city and we're all in the same media business, then eventually you're going to hear about something like that. But there was something in that, and I haven't totally finished analyzing it, and I haven't totally figured out what it was, but there was something that spoke to, I guess, a lot of people who aren't in broadcasting and people who have never worked in that sector. And I think that might have been what started to sort of push it beyond the immediate orbit of the Montreal media scene.
Well, it garnered a lot of attention beyond Montreal and even beyond Canada. You got international recognition. That must have surprised you a bit.
It was pretty weird to see people like Roger Ebert retweeting a link to this blog post, because I thought I was talking about Canadian politics and about Canadian media, but I realized that some of the same sort of patterns and maybe some of the same frustrations are felt by journalists in the States as well. And I mean, it turns out as far away as Japan and England and Australia and all the other places that people wrote from to say that they'd read it.
You wrote your manifesto, and I won't go into any great detail as to what you've written. People can go to your blog and take a look at it, and there's a link on my website to your blog so they can read the original and everything that you've written since then. But when you were at CTV, and also before that at CBC, let's just go back to CTV for a minute. Was there something that was there push come to shove? There something that bothered you that you say, you know, I gotta go?
You know what? That's a difficult question to answer, but I can say that there was nothing about the work environment. There was no tipping point with colleagues or with my employers that sparked this. It was really something internal that I think had more to do with the system, with the TV news industry as it's become, than with a specific station or a specific news brand. So it wasn't about CTV. It wasn't about the people that I was working with, because they're some of the most talented people in the business. I mean, they were enormously fun to work with, and I think there's a lot of really great people inside that organization and inside the CBC, which I also had difficulty leaving when I moved over to the private side. But the point is that I think that a lot of the people who work within these news organizations are not realizing their full potential as storytellers or videographers or writers or journalists, and it's not their fault. I think that it's the context. I think that it's the TV news industry that prevents them from doing better journalism.
The feelings and the reasons for your leaving your job at CTV, I'm sure, is not something that happened simply overnight. This is probably something that was building within you, and correct me if I'm wrong, for a while, and maybe even before you left the CBC. Would that be correct in saying?
You know what? I think everybody has days when they're frustrated, and everybody, you know, not just in the broadcast industry, but people question the mandate of the institution that they serve all over the place, be they firefighters or police or librarians or professors. I think that I had moments like that where I wondered what all my effort was going towards, what I was trying to build towards, what I was making and where I was going, and where the CBC was going. But I would say that must have been cumulative, because it didn't really reach that breaking point until one weekend when I was working at CTV. I don't know whether it would have happened if I'd stayed at one network, but I suspect that it would have. I think that it had less to do with the brand that was on my microphone and with the time that I'd spent and the sort of contradictions that I saw around me.
Well, the reason I ask is I was just wondering if maybe your leaving the CBC in the first place was kind of a preview of your eventually leaving CTV as well.
Style-wise, I don't think there was any indication that that this was going to happen. I mean, it caught me just as much by surprise when I finally came to the decision. You know, I was as surprised as the people that I was trying to explain it to. It's difficult to express, but it's really as if a switch is flipped, or as if you've just reached this U-turn in the road, and one day everything is fine. And someone said to me at the time, you know, you left and went to work one person, and you came back totally different. And it literally was that kind of night and day switch where I woke up the next morning and I couldn't do it. I couldn't see myself playing that character anymore on TV.
Okay, so as you alluded to earlier, some people have the nefarious idea that this whole thing was orchestrated as some sort of book deal. So let's talk about the future. What is the future for you? Here we are, the second full week of September. What's on Kind of Goddess plate?
Well, some people did approach me with a book deal, but that's not something that I think I can jump into in the short term. I've got to really start to go back to work and to try to do my job without any of the resources that I used to have as a network, big network television reporter. So I'm not taking the fall off. I'm writing a number of articles, and I'm starting work on a documentary project. A couple of documentaries, actually, but one of them is going to be produced this fall, so that's going to take me down to California to shoot a project that I want to try to do something different with distribution-wise. And I think that what I want to do is release it for free online in episodes so that you can watch little bitty chunks at a time, just because I know nobody has time to watch a whole 20 minutes or half an hour. But I think that if we can break up the documentary into natural episodes and then release that for free, that we can actually build some interest towards the climax, the moment of truth that's going to be happening just before Christmas down in California.
And what kind of stories is it that you want to tell, especially now that you don't have any editorial judgment above you to concern yourself with? What is it you want to get out to the rest of the world?
Well, you know what? I would say that I do have editors. I mean, I have partners that I work with. For example, at the TAI, I have an editor, a very talented editor by the name of David Beers, who spent a long time himself in the corporate media world on the print side. And I'm getting a lot of guidance and a lot of advice from mentors, both within the industry and who've left it. So it's not as if I'm operating in a vacuum, but more importantly, I'm getting feedback, I'm soliciting feedback from the people who are actually going to be reading and viewing and hopefully listening to some of the content that I'm going to be producing over the next few years. And so I really see the audience as being the ultimate arbiter of how far I can go. And I mean, literally, I'm asking audience members to finance the production of these pieces. So that makes the people watching it the producers and the owners of the material. So that is a voice that I need to listen to in terms of setting the sort of editorial boundaries around what kind of stories I'm going to be covering. That said, there's a few different directions that I'm sort of going in right now. And the first story that I want to tell is about the media convergence scene in Quebec. And this is something that I witnessed firsthand as a reporter at the National Assembly. And I want to talk about and explore the political influence, the cultural influence that becomes possible when you combine all of these very powerful media properties under the same roof. And so I'm taking Quebecor, which is a Montreal-based media company with holdings across Canada, and I'm using that as the example that I think actually sets a template for what a lot of big telecom companies are doing right now in terms of buying up properties across different facets of the telecom and media worlds, and then using them to cross-promote each other and to sort of concentrate their presence in a market. So I'm exploring the kinds of influence that are possible, and I think that the big test for Quebecor this fall is whether they can get the Quebec government to pass a special law protecting their hockey arena. So that's one story that I'm working on right now. But the next story I want to do is completely apolitical, and that's the story down in California. And all I can really say about that is that I've met a very remarkable person who's going to try to do something that should be impossible. And I guess we'll see. I don't know what the ending of the story is going to be, but personally, I'm very inspired by the subject of the documentary. And I think that that if I feel that, then other people might too.
We have just about a minute, and some people mentioned, and there's a lot of articles written about your manifesto and what you had written on your blog. Some people saying that you had burned bridges, some people applauding what you did. Have you had the opportunity, since all this has taken place, to speak to your previous employers? That's part one of the question. And part two, would you ever go back to mainstream broadcasting in any way, shape, or form?
Well, let's start with part one. I mean, if I do have regrets, it's around the haste with which, I guess, I got this this impulse. I mean, this is something that was more powerful than me. I couldn't have stayed, I don't think. The way that it went down in the final days and the negotiations over a possible leave of absence, and anyhow, that fell through. And so
I was forced to make a decision much quicker than I had hoped for. And that, I think, has left somewhat of a bitter taste. And for that, I apologize to my former employers. I think that that's not particularly fair as an employee to pull the rug out like that. And I recognize that bridges may have been burnt. I hope not permanently. Certainly, I bear no ill will towards the people that that mentored me and put their trust in me and hired me. And I understand if they're annoyed with me, but that's something that I hope, given time, that we can heal. The other question about going back to mainstream broadcasting, I think I can only answer by saying that unless the entire industry changes, unless there's a significant shift in the direction and the purpose of mainstream television media, that I don't think I could go back. I couldn't justify that compromise to myself now that I know what it's like to be on the outside, because it's absolutely worth it. And aside from the regrets over the relationship being damaged with some of the individuals that I knew at CTV, I mean, this is the best decision I've ever made in my life.
Well, Kai, I wish you well in all that you do. And people can find out more information by going to your website, correct?
That's right. I'll be posting updates to my projects on Twitter and at my blog, which is kainagata.com.
Thank you very much, Kai.
No problem, Peter.
Freelance journalist Kai Nagata. Again, you can check out his blog at kainagata.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0108, and you'll find links to Kai's site.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
Still to come on the program, we'll talk to actress, producer, and writer Susan Graham about her short film. And we'll have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. Plus, there is, of course, an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. Well, police in Indiana have arrested 43-year-old Byron Womack after they spotted him running shirtless down I-65 with a sword. Womack had allegedly abandoned his Toyota in the middle of the highway to make his run. He was marching with a 35-inch-long samurai sword on the inner shoulder of the highway. A police spokesperson said Womack swung the sword in a defensive manner when approached by officers. He later dropped the sword when ordered to do so. When questioned by police, Womack described himself as being, and this is a direct quote, "cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs." Yeah, there is really nothing more that I can
add to that. So let's just move along. Aaron Margella is a former Wisconsin firefighter, and the state has ruled him permanently disabled and unfit for duty, so he gets paid $50,000 a year to stay home. He doesn't have to pay taxes, his health insurance is free, and he never has to work again if he doesn't want to. But strangely enough, he's fit enough to participate in Ironman contests. Margella completed the 2010 Madison Ironman Triathlon in 12 hours, 24 minutes, but he says, "I can't raise a ladder. There's stuff I can't do. I have minor limitations, but it doesn't stop me from getting out and enjoying stuff like this." In fact, Margella has completed at least 7 marathons and 1 triathlon, all after the state declared him to be permanently disabled from performing his duties as a firefighter. Now, duty disability is a system set up to protect police officers and firefighters from the inherent dangers of their profession. But that's not how Margella was injured. In 2006, he bumped his elbow on a kitchen countertop at the firehouse, causing numbness in his pinky finger. 8 months later, he bumped the same elbow on a ladder, doing further damage to his ulnar nerve. That's better known to you and I as the funny bone. When he still wasn't medically cleared for full duty after a year, North Shore Fire Chief Robert Whitaker says the department gave him a choice of applying for disability or finding another job. So at the age of 28, the Ironman competitor became one of the youngest firefighters in the state to start collecting duty disability, a benefit he's eligible to receive for life. For his part, Margella has offered to come back to work, saying, "I offered to do any of the jobs they wanted to do. I wrote him a letter last year and said, 'Is there anything you can get me doing?' The North Shore Fire Department turned him down." Wow. Surely there's, you know, a desk job at the fire department where the heaviest thing he would have to lift would be a pencil. Surely he can do that. He actually wants to do that. He wants to do anything. He wants to work in the fire department. Why won't you let him? $50,000 a year for life. That's what he's getting to sit at home. Anyway. Moving right along, meteorologist Brett Cummins of Little Rock, Arkansas TV station KARK did not have a good Labor Day weekend. A friend woke him up Labor Day morning after finding him asleep in a hot tub next to a naked dead guy. The victim was 24-year-old Dexter Williams, who was blue in the face, had a dog collar around his neck, and lying near Cummins' shoulder. Christopher Barber was the friend who made the grisly discovery and told police the two men were at his home the night before, drinking and snorting drugs. So apparently there was snow in the forecast. Police haven't determined the cause of death, but a detective allegedly found a ring of blood in the bottom of the empty tub. In the meantime, police are waiting for autopsy results and, amazingly, don't consider Cummins a suspect. However, KARK announced that Cummins wouldn't be on the air because, quote, he's mourning the loss of a friend, unquote. Something tells me he'll soon be mourning the loss of a job. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in Amsterdam, Dutch police have charged a 42-year-old woman with stalking after she allegedly called her ex-boyfriend 65,000 times in the past year. Assuming she called every day for one full year, that works out to over 178 phone calls per day. Every day. The 62-year-old victim filed a police complaint due to the persistent phone calls. Police arrested the suspected stalker after seizing several cell phones and computers from her home in Rotterdam. Amazingly, she argued to judges at her preliminary hearing that she had a relationship with the victim and she felt the number of calls she placed with him wasn't excessive. The victim denied they had a relationship. The court ordered her not to contact him again. In Amsterdam, when you get arrested, do you get to make one phone call? If so, I wonder who she dialed. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Susan Graham is a producer, writer, and actress. Her latest film is a short film called Quiet, which is making the rounds at film festivals. She has spent quite a bit of time writing and producing for Comedy Central, but now she's ready to step back out in front of the camera. Susan joins us from California. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you've got this film called Quiet. Tell us what it's about.
Sure. Well, the film, we like to say, is about love and loss. And more specifically, it's about gay medical rights. And it's about a woman named Allie, who I play, who has to lie and say she is her lover's sister so that she can have access to her in sort of a horrible medical situation in a small Texas town.
What led you to this story in the first place?
Well, I think I read online. I try to keep track of news, and I always have. And I was really struck by the Janice Langben, Lisa Pond story, which I think the actual incident happened in 2007. But basically, these two women had been legally married for years and were on a family vacation. And I think Lisa actually suffered an aneurysm, and Janice wasn't allowed to be with her for her final hours, and her children weren't allowed to visit. And it was a really heartbreaking story. And I remember reading that and thinking, you know, two people in love in the worst moments of their lives, you know, and especially saying goodbye to someone, you know, you should be able to have the person that you love there with you. And that really kind of stuck with me. And I remember also just wanting to do a dramatic short film. So when that came to me, I realized that, you know, these two ideas were something that I could work with. And the final film version is actually very different from the Janice and Lisa story, but I think the heart of it is very similar.
Was it difficult getting this movie made? And the reason why I asked that question is, you know, you want to do a short dramatic film. It's clearly a very heavy topic, and people know you from your work before in Comedy Central, and there are people, and I'm sure there are some people who are saying, oh, no, Susan, bring us the laughs. We don't want this.
I know. You know, I have to say that with short films, luckily we were able to mostly self-fund because the budget wasn't exorbitant, because we're talking about a 25-minute short as opposed to, you know, your typical 90 to 120-minute narrative feature. And I think that the topic really moved people, so we were able to get a lot of crew and cast to donate their time or take deferred payments, which was really lovely. And that's something that you don't often see in comedy, because people are like, yeah, it's just comedy, and it's a little bit less serious, so they won't necessarily show up for free. But yeah, the script really got people.
Let's talk a little bit about your career. You moved to LA from Texas, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes, actually, you know, I lived in New York, and then I moved from New York to Los Angeles, but I'm originally from Texas.
Okay, so before making the leap from New York to Texas, was that a bit of, shall we say, culture shock for you?
Absolutely. I grew up in a small town in Texas named McAllen, which was a lovely, wonderful place to grow up. And I lived about 20 miles from the border. So Spanish was actually my first language, which is really interesting, because when you look at me, you wouldn't think that I would speak Spanish. But I remember a bit of it. And as a kid, I spoke it fluently. And it was warm all the time, humid all the time. I think we have like 10 months of 90 degrees and above. And I was just like a sunshine kid. You know, that's how I was raised. And then I moved back east for college and stayed and went to New York and did theater and off Broadway. And I did a tour. And so that was really gratifying. But I realized that I wanted to do TV and film. So I moved to Los Angeles.
Is there any kind of big misconceptions that you had to get over in moving to L.A., or did basically the experiences you had in New York erase some of those initial thoughts?
Well, you know, the thing about some New Yorkers, I don't want to say everyone, but a lot of New Yorkers have sort of a prejudice against Los Angeles, so I have to say I was a little fearful to move out here, because I thought it would just be a town full of superficial, materialistic, really, you know, stuck-up people, and I wouldn't fit in at all. But I have to say, when I got here, the weather, number one, I don't even mind the earthquakes. The weather is perfect all the time. So compared to, like, 10 feet of snow I was used to every year, I was pretty thrilled. And I found, you know, really great friends and really wonderful people to work with. And while, yes, I mean, there are a lot more breast implants in the city and a lot more tanning salons, I think that people are generally warm, you know, and happy. And you can find, you know, good quality people anywhere. So I have to say, a lot of my judgments about Los Angeles before I moved here as being sort of an intellectual, snobby New Yorker were definitely wrong.
So you've done some stage in New York. You're an actress. You're a writer and producer. You've done some stuff for Comedy Central. You now have this short film. Is this the career path you've plotted for yourself? Are you on track to do what you want to do? Or have you veered off in any way, shape, or form from your original plans?
Well, you know, one thing that is new for me is the writing and producing aspect. Well, semi-new. That's really just been since I've been in Los Angeles. And I think that I knew always that I wanted to perform and that I wanted to do both comedy and drama. But, you know, I came up in theater school. You know, that's what my degree is in. And there's really a big separation between writers and performers. If you're a playwright, you're a playwright. If you're an actor, you're an actor. And the two don't cross. And I think it wasn't really until I was immersed in the entertainment industry in Los Angeles that I saw it's a lot more open and forgiving. Here, actors are directors and directors are writers, and everybody kind of does things that they're passionate about and kind of figures out their niche. And I realized that, I could spread my wings that way. So I think in that sense, I veered off, but actually found, I don't know, more fulfilling roles that I can write myself, and then I can produce the film. So that's been kind of incredible. I've kind of actually stayed on track by going off track, if you will.
You say you like doing comedy and drama. Do you have a preference between either one?
You know, it kind of depends on when you ask me. I've just finished this very dramatic short, and I am desperate to do some more comedy. And when I was had done enough comedy for a while, I remember thinking, oh, man, I need to just sink my teeth into drama. So I guess I'm just a creature of variety. I like to do everything, you know. But, yeah, it depends on the day, I guess.
And you don't find, as an actress, especially as a woman, that you don't have people trying to typecast you in one or the other?
You know, I do think that once you start doing more comedy, they tend to sort of ask for that. I think mostly because females in comedy are a bit of an anomaly still in this day and age. I know that's hard to imagine, but, you know, women that write their own projects and do their own things in comedy, you know, kind of have a strong point of view. It's still rarer in comedy than I would say in different parts of the entertainment industry. So I would say if there is going to be any typecasting in my career, it will probably be on the comedy spectrum. But I'm lucky in the sense that if I am ever sort of really hungry for a dramatic role, you know, I did get to write and produce my own. So I feel like that shows the different facets of my training and my character.
I mentioned in the introduction that your film Quiet is making the rounds at some film festivals. How can people have an opportunity generally to see the film Quiet?
Absolutely. Well, we hope to have a screening in L.A., I'd say in the fall. And we are definitely still waiting to hear back from film festivals. But as soon as we do, it's the beginning of festival season, we hope to get in to, you know, the big ones. So everyone would be able to go see them there. And our big goal is to get, because of the subject matter, to get into Outfest, which would be almost a year from now in July of next year. But definitely we'll get into some festivals before then and let you know when those dates are.
And you have a website, so that's SusanGraham.tv, correct?
It is.
And I'm sure you'll keep people up to date as to where and when they can see the film on your site as well, right?
I will. I definitely will.
What's up next for you, besides getting this film a wider audience?
I know, absolutely. I am. We're working on the feature-length version of the film because we want to have that script completed by the time it does make the rounds in the festival circuit, so by the end of the fall, early 2012. So that's going to be on the writing end. And then in the performing end, you know, like any other actor, I have some auditions and opportunities coming up. So I can't tell you too much about those because who knows if they'll pan out. But in terms of my own producing, I am working on a live sketch show with another one of my writing partners, Erica Barden, and we're going to do some like funny little web shorts and perform that in Los Angeles. So if you want to come see me in person, I'll have that up on my website, and we're looking to do that around the holidays.
Excellent. The current film, as you mentioned, your short film, which is hopefully making the rounds, is called Quiet. And Susan, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great.
Filmmaker Susan Graham. Her film is called Quiet. You can check out her website at susangraham.tv. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0108. And you can find links to Susan's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. If you've ever asked a child what their favorite part of the school day is, chances are they replied, recess. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's easy to forget how much learning actually takes place on the playground. The games and other things going on there are not only fun, they build confidence and help children become comfortable with taking risks. An article in the New York Times this summer revealed that risk-taking on the playground is extremely important to child development. Unfortunately, it also revealed that children have lost some of the best opportunities for conquering their fears. Why? Because things like monkey bars and tall slides that used to be there are vanishing due to fear of lawsuits. Let's be fair. When experts tell us that today's safer playgrounds can actually stunt development and leave children with anxieties that are worse than a broken bone, it's time for a change. It's time to demand better from courts that help create this situation. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter. Hi, Stu.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo as we work our way into the fall.
You know, I just got to tell you very quickly, I think I may have told you before about the wonders of eBay. Now I'm starting to acquire some nice books from my collection through eBay.
Yes.
So now I'm going the James Bond route. I've been able to put some bids on some nice hardcover editions of some of my favorite Bond novels, but the British ones. And so far the prices have been terrific. I'm paying next to nothing for them. That would go for like thousands of dollars. But I'm in a bidding war with somebody over the hardcover edition of Dr. No from 1958 right now.
Well, I wouldn't brag about that too much loudly on an internet radio program that is heard around the world, because you're saying you're getting them for next to nothing. Maybe somebody out there listening to that will say, time to bid against Stuart.
Well, put it this way, get your computer ready, because there are a couple of volumes that I will be willing to fight for.
Okay. What do we have this week?
Well, speaking of mystery thrillers, because the reason I did say that, to bridge into it, we're going to look at Kathy Reich's latest thriller called Flesh and Bones. Now, the world of forensic anthropologist Temperance Brennan is filled with murder, intrigue, cold cases, and the bones from victims of those cold cases. And no matter where she is, whether it be in Montreal or her hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina, somehow all those factors make up Ms. Brennan's world that never fails to pop up and create a good old-fashioned criminal investigation. And in Kathy Reich's latest thriller, Flesh and Bones, the world of the NASCAR racing circuit becomes the scene of the crime. The book entirely takes place in Brennan's home turf of Mecklenburg County in North Carolina. Particularly, it's focused on the fast-paced excitement of NASCAR Race Week. Brennan is called when a body is found encased in a drum filled with asphalt, which is discovered on the site of the Charlotte Motor Speedway, where over 200,000 rabid NASCAR fans plan to spend the week catching the various series that make up Race Week. Somehow, during the course of her investigation, the body is linked to the mysterious disappearance 12 years earlier of the sister of the member of a NASCAR driver's technical crew, who vanished with her boyfriend, who in turn was suspected of defecting from a local extremist right-wing militia group that he was part of. And to add to the case, to make it even further, a deadly poisonous substance, which is similar to ricin, which was used in the murder of a Bulgarian dissident in 1978, is found near the encased body. Now, the pacing of Flesh and Bones is almost as fast as a typical NASCAR race, but the reader is not running around in circles trying to figure out the identity of the encased body and what happened to the young couple who disappeared under mysterious circumstances. Now, Reichs gives us a good entertaining read with Flash and Bones. The tone of the book reads like a hard-boiled pulp detective novel, with Brennan personally narrating the story of she was either Sam Spade or Mike Hammer. And thanks to Reich's meticulous research, we are deeply enveloped into the world of the NASCAR auto racing circuit, even its colorful history, which dates back to the early 1930s. And at the end of the book, for all you Kathy Reichs fans, there's a Q&A with the author, who details the story behind the writing of Flash and Bones, as well as the difference between writing one of her Temperance Brennan novels and putting together a script for the hit Fox TV series Bones. Now, Flash and Bones, if you allow me to say, is formulated Kathy Reichs. But as a mystery thriller, it crosses the finish line to take first place.
Well, let me ask you this, because you say that it's narrated in a sort of Sam Spade kind of way and quality.
Yeah.
Is this different from the style she normally writes her novels in?
Yeah, because, you know, I found it to be very, how can I say, sometimes very technical, sometimes very graphic with the, you know, how she investigates going through the cadaver that she discovers and, you know, going through, like, all the body parts and what have you. And sometimes it can be very technical, sometimes cerebral. So I found this one, like, very hard-boiled in a way. You know, it's sort of like she should be narrating this in black and white with a cigarette dangling from her lips, you know, wearing a trench coat.
Do you think in any way, shape, or form she has been influenced by how her character has manifested herself on the small screen?
I mean, it's very possible. I mean, sometimes you have to, diverse yourself a little bit. I mean, even Ian Fleming diversed himself sometimes with some of his Bond novels. Case in point, The Spy Who Loved Me, which is the narrative was written from the point of view of the heroine herself, not a third-person description of the Bond adventure. And if you remember, if you read the book, James Bond only appears like more than halfway through the story. But it's told from a different point of view. So sometimes you have to sometimes branch out a little bit. I think this is Kathy Rex's way of branching out.
Speaking of which, the same could be said for From Russia with Love.
Oh, exactly. And that was like one of his best novels that took place in the Cold War.
Yeah.
But also, if you liked, corner type of books, I may recommend also Kathy Rex's very first novel, Deja Dead, that really started the ball rolling. I mean, she hit the ground running with this one. And, this really sets the pace of how, forensic thrillers should be like, actually. And also, if you want a little bit of nonfiction in the coroner section, the coroner corner, read Thomas Noguchi's memoir, Coroner, which was published in 1982. He was basically the coroner to the stars, if such a thing as possible, and talks about some of his famous cases, especially dealing with Sharon Tate, with Marilyn Monroe, and John Belushi. It's really fascinating stuff, and I think he was almost like the inspiration for Quincy, if I remember correctly.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, so here you go. It's all here, laying it on the table for you.
Excellent. And since you mentioned Bond not once, but a couple of times in this process, it seems to be you have Bond on the mind. As you know, I love my Kindle.
Yes, you do.
And one of the things I've been doing is I've been reading the Bond books in the order that they were written in. I am now up, ironically, to, I guess it would be book number 6, which would be Dr. No.
And a good book, too.
And a good book, too. So whatever it is somebody is into reading, be it Bond, be it romance novels, be it biographies, if you haven't picked up a Kindle, or I'm not just speaking for Kindle, I just love Kindle, but if you haven't picked up a Kindle or other e-readers, I suggest you do so, because it's a great way, and another way. I'm not going to say they're going to replace books completely, nor should they, but it's another great way to read, and I just love my Kindle.
I agree, because I took my Kobo with me when I went to Wisconsin this past summer, so it was very compact, very handy, and got to read From Here to Eternity, all 900-odd pages of it, too. Yeah.
Anyway, so getting back to Kathy Reichs, her latest book is called what, and how can we get it?
Well, it's called Flash and Bones. It's published by Scribner, and it's $29.99.
Excellent. And how can people get in contact and find the work that you do?
Well, you can read me every week in the West End Times on paper, but if you can't read me on paper, you can read me online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolman, another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we have time for a few more Stuff File stories in the news, and of course, an idiot of the day. While with her parents in a snack shop at Belfast Royal Victoria Hospital in the UK, 18-year-old Danielle Burns had an epileptic seizure. But what her father, David Burns, found the most shocking was the way the other customers reacted. As he held his daughter's head in his arms while paramedics and a doctor treated her, other customers simply pushed past them, reaching for their food. David said one man actually asked the paramedics treating his daughter to pass him a milkshake. David recalls, "We were all sort of busy around Danielle and talking between ourselves, making sure she was okay, when this man said, 'Excuse me, mate,'" tapping the paramedic on the shoulder, "'you wouldn't mind handing me that banana milkshake?' The paramedic just shook his head and looked at David and his wife, saying, 'That's disgusting.'" Wow. Milkshakes must be great there. And in Darbyville, Mississippi, police arrested 35-year-old Nathan Mark Hardy at a Winn-Dixie grocery store after he allegedly was caught trying to steal food. Somehow, Hardy thought it would be easy for him to get away with stuffing two bags of jumbo shrimp, a pork loin, and two live lobsters into his cargo pants. When Hardy was accosted by store employees, he tried to escape by throwing the pork loin at them. Police arrested him at the scene. Dude, seriously, live lobsters in your pants? Really? Anyway, it seems to be that the Chinese have no qualms about taking someone else's intellectual property and using it for themselves with a clear conscience. Case in point, anyone with a smartphone has probably heard of the popular game app Angry Birds. But in China, an unlicensed Angry Bird theme park has now opened that offers visitors a chance to use real slingshots to knock birds and pigs off of an elaborate structure. Don't worry. The pigs and birds are not real, but the game's owner are still not too pleased and have filed an intellectual property case against the park. Rovio, the Finnish company responsible for the usually popular game, has reportedly been in talks with Disney earlier this summer about an Angry Birds attraction. But the Chinese Angry Birds Park is in the city of Changsha and is a little more than 430 miles north of Hong Kong as the Angry Bird flies. I tell you, Western companies who want to go after Chinese companies over copyright, the line starts at the Chinese border and spans the globe. Anyway, we learned something new from Southern California. Gumby is a lousy robber. Apparently, a person in a full Gumby costume entered a 7-Eleven convenience store and demanded money. The clerk thought it was a joke and ignored Gumby, telling him he was cleaning up and didn't have time to waste. Gumby responded by saying, "You don't think this is a robbery? I have a gun!" The costumed man then fumbled inside his costume as if trying to retrieve a weapon, but the big green glove seemed to get in the way, and rather than pull out a gun, he dropped 26 cents on the floor. All this was caught on video surveillance, which then shows a second man who came in with Gumby walk out of the store, jump into a minivan, and pull up in front of the store and honk. Gumby then took off, jumped in the van, and the two drove away. Amazingly, the clerk didn't even think this was worth reporting, but his boss called police after viewing the surveillance tape several hours later. But police are taking the attempted theft very seriously and are on the lookout for Gumby and his accomplice, so they can probably throw them in the pokey. Yes. I almost made that clown, the guy in the Gumby costume, the idiot of the day, but I didn't. But this guy is.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
Okay, this one is short and sweet. In Durango, Colorado, Sean Ogden, age 19, was seriously burned in July when he tried to break down fireworks he had purchased in order to build even bigger ones. He was mixing them in a coffee grinder. Sean lacks a lot of things. He probably lacks the basic knowledge of high school chemistry. He lacks the intuitive process of a well-thought-out plan. He lacks any common sense. That's because Sean is an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0108. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff again is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And at the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that number is 0108. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.